Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
I am far more concerned than what's happening at the editorial page by what's happening in news pages.
Molly Hemingway speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
In news pages, that old idea that we had for a few decades of aiming toward objectivity has just been completely thrown out the window.
And this is a generalization, but I think it bears out. And again, I mean, even 5-10 years ago, it would have sounded crazy that I'd be saying this, but I mean, I think it is the case. You have to view the explicit goal of most of the major journalistic institutions in this country as electing Democrats. And when they aren't electing Democrats, they're trying to push the Democratic Party further left.
You can watch and listen to a recording of journalists Mark and Molly Hemingway's Q&A from our 2020 Making the Case conference. It's available in both video and audio formats for a tax-deductible contribution of $250. Learn more at issuesetc.org. I think it's fair to say that things are heating up, especially with the media, getting closer and closer to those November elections. There are tell-all books, one from a former attorney for President Donald Trump, another from the storied journalist Bob Woodward. They're all making their splash in their own ways. Well, what do we do with the fact that the president is also running for office? And part of that is announcing some Supreme Court prospective nominee should he serve that second term. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us for an update on the November elections, Mark Hemingway. He's senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. Mark, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
And Molly Hemingway, Fox News contributor, senior editor of The Federalist, and author of the book Justice on Trial. Molly, welcome.
Great to be here with you.
Molly, you first. What are your thoughts on the 19th anniversary of the attacks on September 11th, 2001?
Well, Mark and I lived in Washington, D.C. at the time of the attacks, and we always reflect at this time of year on what that was like to go through. But one thing that was interesting to me was that this is the first year where it actually seems like it was the right number of years that matches with the actual number of years. It used to be, you know, I can't believe it's been a year, or I can't believe it's been 10 years. Now it actually does kind of seem like it was 19 years ago. And so much of the world has changed. A lot of it, unfortunately, not for the better. But I'm glad to see people are still remembering it and thinking about all the people who lost their lives and just what a traumatic day that was for so many people.
Mark, what are your thoughts?
Well, a couple of years ago, Molly and I were driving actually back from the Republican convention in Cleveland in 2016, and we took a sort of off the beaten path way route home because we were driving, and we went out of our way to go see the 9/11 memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where Flight 93 crashed. And Molly and I were both living on Capitol Hill at the time, a few blocks from the Capitol itself, and it's sort of very moving to visit that memorial because Flight 93, they think, may have been headed to the Capitol. You know, for all we know, that, you know, the heroes on board, you know, might have saved our, you know, one or both of our lives. So, yeah, I mean, we do certainly reflect upon this personally. But, you know, we're also in politics, and, you know, there's always a lot that goes on in this day. And it's also depressing to see that there's a lot of people, you know, they're trying to score political points off this on social media today, you know, in the mainstream media and otherwise. And it's just, you know, a real shame to sort of reflect back, I think, in some ways, like this year in particular, because it's an election year and the Trump era and all that. It just feels particularly acute that there's so much politics going on right now. You know, even 9/11 isn't a moment time for national unity, and just kind of makes me a little bit sad.
Molly, The Atlantic ran a story alleging that President Trump called World War I soldiers killed in battle losers and suckers. What can you tell us about this Atlantic story, and will this impact support for the president?
Yeah, The Atlantic put out a story based on what they claimed were four anonymous sources saying that the real reason why President Trump didn't visit Ain Marne World War I cemetery in France was because he didn't want to get his hair wet and because he didn't like World War I dead. And it was pretty immediately debunked. I mean, the contemporaneous documentation about why that trip was canceled is so extensive. General Kelly canceled it because of rain, because it was too dangerous to fly. I actually happened to visit that cemetery in July. I was covering a White House trip there and drove the roads, and I can confirm that there's no way they would ever let a U.S. president drive the roads there because it's too much of a security risk. And you had something like, you know, 24 people who were involved in the discussions of the trip debunking the claims made in that story. But it was interesting that it became a big story nonetheless. There was no substantiation for it other than four anonymous claims. It was refuted by just tons of on-the-record evidence, not just about that trip, but in general, President Trump tends to love military pomp and circumstance. He loves to visit with veterans. He loves to visit with disabled veterans. He makes trips to Walter Reed. He invites them into the Oval Office. There are tons of pictures and videos of him hugging disabled veterans. And so while he had said very negative things about, for instance, Senator John McCain and other like individual military figures, it just didn't really match with reality. So it seemed to go nowhere. But it was clearly part of an operation that I think people should get used to, of just every few days there will be a hit piece along these lines that is for political purposes.
We're getting an update on the November elections with Mark Hemingway, senior writer for Real Clear Investigations, and Molly Hemingway, Fox News contributor and senior editor of The Federalist. She's also co-author of the book Justice on Trial. When we come back, we'll find out what Mark thinks about that Atlantic story claiming that President Trump disparaged the World War I war dead.
Independent and in the black for 12 years and running, you're listening to Issues Etc.
This is a message for pastors and lay leaders of Missouri Synod congregations. As we enter the last quarter of 2020, how are you doing and how's your church doing? What has the COVID lockdown done to your attendance and giving? In 25% of our churches, giving's actually gone up. So why are some churches struggling and others thriving? Here at LCMS Stewardship and the whole Office of National Mission Team, we have answers and we have help for you and your church today. LCMS.org/stewardship.
Jesus the Good Shepherd says, "My sheep listen to my voice. I know them and they follow me. I give them eternal life." We invite you to join us as we listen to the voice of the Good Shepherd and follow him who gives us eternal life. Sunday worship services at 9 a.m., Sunday school and Bible class at 10:30, Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri, on the web at goodshepherdarnold.org. That's goodshepherdarnold.org.
Everything suddenly switched in March to coronavirus is going to kill us all. You know, shut everything down. Everyone hide in your basement. Assume a fetal position. Don't go anywhere unless you work for Amazon.
I love my wife and I love my kids and I can't imagine living without them. But I need to see them as gifts from God, not gods that I can't live without.
It was the historic upbuilding and intrusion of the federal government in corners of American life where it had never previously had so much as a scintilla of a role.
Right when God created Adam and Eve, he had them work. Work was not the result of sin.
In a half hour, we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We have a soundbite on the Democratic track record, on COVID and school reopening, one on the fear of the death of your loved ones, another on government never being the source of family restoration, and the final soundbite for your consideration here in about a half hour, how Christians changed labor. In the meantime, we're getting an update on the November elections. Mark Hemingway is our guest, and Molly Hemingway as well of The Federalist. Mark, we were talking before the break about that Atlantic article that accused President Trump of disparaging war dead. What did you make of it?
I mean, I think there are now something like 21 people on record that you know, either on the trip or have direct knowledge of what happened there that are on the record denying it. The story itself is completely anonymously sourced. And really, at this point in time, the media is constantly sort of wagering its credibility against Trump's. And while I agree that Trump isn't always scrupulous with facts and you know, the truth even, neither is the media. And we've seen time and time again in the Trump era where the media are not content with, you know, hitting Trump with, you know, all manner of, you know, legitimate criticisms that they could put out there. Instead, they just constantly, like, overreach, and they go for, like, the most dramatic examples, you know, with anonymous sources that they can find. And it's really sort of dispiriting. And I don't think the media quite realize what they're doing here, which is to say that, you know, yes, I get it, they don't like Trump, and they want him out of office. But I am sincerely worried about the fact that long after Trump is out of office, the media is now going to has decided from here on out that it's okay to, you know, go out and make scurrilous, you know, character accusations against people that they don't like politically, you know, anonymously, and do this again and again and again. You know, this isn't journalism. I mean, the norms for this kind of journalistic practice have evolved so rapidly since I graduated from journalism school 20 years ago. I mean, this would have been unconscionable, you know, which is what I was taught in journalism school. And yet they do it with just absolute regularity now, and I don't think the media quite realizes how damaging it is to their institutional credibility and how that's going to be a big problem for them long after Trump is out of office.
Molly, Bob Woodward of Watergate fame has a new book out. Woodward has a recording of President Trump made back in February, I believe, speaking about coronavirus. And the quote is, "I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down because I don't want to create a panic." What's your reaction?
Yeah, there are so many things here. Bob Woodward writes a book every couple of years, and he has just amazing access combined with some creativity in how he presents his information. And I'm always surprised that he gets people to talk to him because in my estimation, he doesn't actually do a good job of accurately portraying what people say. But President Trump spoke to him on the record 18 times for this book for unknown reasons. And then as the book rolled out, they portrayed a bunch of quotes as being somehow nefarious or bad. But I actually did not understand this particular hit piece against him. It definitely caused all the typical people to get outraged and whatnot. But he was quoted saying in February that it was very serious, that this coronavirus pandemic was very serious. And then like a month later, he talks to Woodward and he says, "No, I'm always trying to play it down. I still like playing it down because I don't want to create a panic." Well, this is exactly what he said publicly at the same time. So I wasn't sure why it was such a big deal. We knew he took it seriously because he shut down travel from China. He announced a public health emergency in January. He put together a task force in January. That border shutdown happened in January. It was happening at the time that he was getting impeached, incidentally, if you're wondering what other people were doing. And then in March, Jim Acosta from CNN said, "You always seem to be downplaying this. Why are you?" And he said, "I don't want to cause a panic." So I'm not really sure why it was such a big deal. You can disagree with the idea that you should work to not incite panic, but I don't see how the, you know, I feel like people forget what they went through and they forget that they got outraged by this in March. But I do think there's an argument that Trump might not have, I mean, he clearly did not want people to panic and shut down the whole country. I don't think he did enough to stop that. So whereas big media is saying he was wrong to not incite more panic, I think there is legitimate criticism in the opposite direction. He could have done more, had a more even hand in keeping people from panicking into these mass shutdowns that have destroyed so many businesses and hurt so many people's lives.
Well, Mark, my reaction was, of course, retrospect is 2020, and it appears to me that the media are kind of memory holding their own reactions to Trump's travel ban and things like that. And, well, I don't know what to call it, rewriting history.
Oh, yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, I kind of hate that every story these days turns into this, you know, sort of meta, you know, navel gazing story about the media, but there's just no way around it with, you know, the sort of hyperbole that gets thrown around about this stuff. Yeah, it's absolutely true. You know, you had media outlet after media outlet, including, you know, lots of Democratic politicians as well, being celebrated by the media for calling Trump racist for instituting the travel ban and to China and saying it wouldn't be effective anyway. There are Washington Post headlines from February saying, you know, "Hey, calm down, everybody. This, you know, is just like the flu." There were CNN hosts on air, you know, comparing this to the flu as late as March. I mean, yes, everybody was kind of all over the map in terms of trying to decide, you know, what level of panic versus reassurance we should have in terms of dealing with an unknown threat. So, yeah, trying to ring Trump up on this strikes me as a bit unfair. Never mind that we have this weird issue here where Woodward is trying to thread this really, you know, difficult needle that, again, suggests his credibility is a bit off. On one hand, we're supposed to believe that Trump said all these shocking things months ago to Woodward that showed that he wasn't taking the virus seriously and doing anything about it. And on the other hand, we're supposed to trust that this wasn't a big enough deal that Woodward didn't run immediately to the Washington Post to print that Trump was, you know, going to get us all killed by the way that he's treating this virus. Woodward himself has been questioned about it, says, well, you know, I didn't think it was serious enough to go out there and report it, you know, immediately. If I thought that Trump was causing some sort of public health threat, I would have reported it immediately. So, yeah, I mean, pick one here. You know, either Trump was not taking it seriously, in which case Woodward should have gone to the press months ago and reported this, or Woodward is out there saying sensational things trying to sell a book. And knowing what I know about Bob Woodward and his history, I think it's door number two.
Molly, you wrote a column for The Federalist titled, "The Media Are Lying About the Election Again." Tell us about it and make your case.
Well, in 2016, big media assured everybody that Donald Trump could not possibly win the Republican nomination. And if he did, he definitely could not defeat Hillary Clinton. And that was the overarching narrative throughout the entire campaign season. And it sort of defined everything that the media talked about and how they portrayed support for Donald Trump as unreasonable and whatnot. And when Donald Trump won, you would have hoped that the media would have been somewhat chastened and improved how they covered things. Instead, they said, well, if you look at our final polls in 2016, they weren't that far off, which I guess technically is true. They're not that far off. What's more interesting is how the polls were discussed in the months prior to the 2016 election win by Trump. And once again, you're seeing the same games being played by big media. August clearly changed the race. You had Joe Biden flub his vice presidential pick. You had him totally squander the opportunity of the Democratic National Convention at the same time that Republicans had a wildly successful convention, and you had riots in the streets that are very closely tied to the Democratic Party. And so all of the movement went toward Donald Trump. Now, he's still behind in all of these polls. Whether or not you accept those polls is entirely another thing. But the movement showed all these battleground states getting closer for Donald Trump within the margin of error. And yet the media narrative that was put out at the end of August, beginning of September, was that the race hadn't really changed at all, that Donald Trump was still on a path for a certain loss and that Joe Biden was definitely going to win. And it included things like saying that Florida was a state that Joe Biden had safely in control. Well, I called out some of the experts for saying that, because if you actually know anything about Florida, even if the polls do frequently show Democrats are going to win, they keep not winning, you know, in 2018, in 2016. And the polls and the movement there show that Florida is definitely tight. Well, I will note that after I wrote my piece, both of the experts that I called out for saying that it was going to go Democrat changed their prognostication, and now they admit that it's a toss-up in Florida.
Mark, President Trump announced a new or revised list of possible Supreme Court nominees should he serve a second term. Will this have any impact on the election?
Well, you know, there hasn't been a lot of discussion about it, certainly, you know, in the media for obvious reasons, but it is very much true that the conservative electorate finds that judges are a very important reason for their vote. Actually, as outlined in Molly's book on Brett Kavanaugh, she talks about, you know, the story behind Trump making a list of judicial Supreme Court nominees that he would pick in 2016, and when he released that list, what an important thing it was for helping his reelection chances and getting the conservative legal movement, which is very influential, on board with his campaign. So, yeah, I mean, I do think that there's a lot of fine choices on that list as far as, you know, conservatives are concerned, and I do think that will be, you know, a net positive for him in the election. At the same time, it's weird, you know, for all of the gnashing of teeth over Kavanaugh and stuff like that, when it comes to elections, you know, liberals just don't seem to care about judges nearly as much. Yeah, I think it's a net positive for Trump.
Molly, what do you think? Because the media's reaction was, oh no, Tom Cotton might be a Supreme Court justice in the future. What did you think of the list and its benefits to the president?
Well, In 2016, one out of four Trump voters cited the Supreme Court as their reason for voting for President Trump. It was clearly quite important to his victory. A lot of people weren't sure if he would be as good as he claimed he would be when he put out that list, but you know, hundreds of nominees later and two justices on the Supreme Court, I think people really do believe that he is good at this part of his job and that it'll be a big thing for them when it comes to voting for him again. The list itself includes some really great names. I mean, one of those things I loved was Kyle Duncan, who's very strong on religious liberty and has been a great federal judge down in Louisiana. The political names, the original, not the original list, but the update in 2016 included a senator, Mike Lee. Ted Cruz had said that he would endorse Trump if he included Mike Lee on his list of potential Supreme Court justices. So it's not the first time we've seen senators on there. But in general, I think the conservative judicial movement believes that you shouldn't just be a senator. You should probably have had actual experience as a judge authoring opinions before you will be viewed by the rest of the movement as legitimate for nomination. There have been just too many judges nominated or too many people nominated who didn't have enough of a track record. And then when they got to the high court, they disappointed people. Even with good track records, you can still have disappointment. So I would say with the exception, possible exception of Ted Cruz, who was a clerk on the court, who has made it known that he would enjoy being a federal judge and who I think has the right temperament that people trust, he would not betray the principles that he claims to uphold. I'm not sure if the rest of those politicians would necessarily be strong contenders, but just a good list, good update, lots of people from across the country, women, some rising stars, and some really solid picks on there.
Molly Hemingway is our guest, senior editor of The Federalist, along with Mark Hemingway, senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. We're getting an update on the November elections. We're going to talk a little bit about critical race theory and the federal government next. Thanks to a generous donor, we've purchased a building for the new studios and offices of Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and The Word of the Lord Endures Forever.
The donor will match up to $200,000 for the purchase and renovation.
The entire cost is approximately $375,000.
You can view an architect's rendering and make a special tax-deductible gift at issuesetc.org.
Or call 618-223-8385.
Thanks for your consideration.
Concordia University Chicago is committed to keeping college affordable for all, and especially for LCMS Lutherans. We have scholarships available specifically for students who are LCMS members. This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, asking you to encourage your student to check out Concordia Chicago at cuchicago.edu. And if you are interested in supporting these scholarships, please find us online at foundation@cuchicago.edu.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Since 1978, Lutheran Church Extension Fund has had the humble privilege of supporting Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Ministries and her workers. Thanks to faithful investors, LCEF has provided thousands of church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations with the low-cost loans and resources they need to reach more people with the saving name of Christ. To learn more, visit lcef.org or call 800-843-5233, 800-843-5233.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at siestakeyrentalgenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Pastor Heath Curtis, Director of Stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, visited our new studios and offices today. LCMS stewardship helps congregations grow in their understanding and implementation with a life of stewardship. They've produced numerous free resources. You can find them at lcms.org/stewardship. Managing the Gifts God Gives Us, LCMS Stewardship Ministry, lcms.org/stewardship. We're getting an update on the November elections. Mark Hemingway and Molly Hemingway are our guests. So, Mark, what is critical race theory, and what are your thoughts on President Trump's directive to ban critical race theory training at federal agencies?
Just as a reminder, if you want to delve into the Issues Etc. archives, which is always a good idea, I did a very long podcast about this topic a few months ago. But in short, basically critical race theory is an outgrowth of critical theory, which is a Marxist sort of academic train of thought that says that everything is governed by a series of hidden power structures that suffuse all institutions and, you know, the way that we perceive the world. And it's your job to achieve justice as a Marxist to root out these unfair power structures and always be pointing them out. And critical race theory is an extension of that to basically say that, you know, the dominant power structures are ones of, you know, race and white privilege, and that therefore, you know, we're not going to ever have any sort of, you know, justice unless we are like constantly sort of like self-flagellating and, you know, trying to root out all of the white privilege everywhere we find it. It, you know, like I said, I mean, it has, you know, straight up Marxist origins. There's no debate about this. Because it's Marxist and it's, you know, sort of class and race based, there is a lot of sort of dishonest, or I should say, ways of viewing the world embedded in critical race theory that do not, say, comport with Christianity in terms of original sin and forgiveness and other things like that. Basically, you know, it sort of strives to create an identity politics hierarchy. And, of course, you know, if you have some sort of privilege, that means that you are, you know, forever bound to be aware of your privilege and, you know, constantly, like I said, be self-flagellating about it. There's a lot that could be said about sort of the specific doctrines and twists and books and scholars and stuff that are currently weighing in on this. But in general, I think it's a good idea that the federal government should set an example here and, you know, not make sure that this kind of, you know, poisons discourse, which basically says that, you know, if you're white, you can, you always have this embedded privilege and you can never be forgiven and you can never, you know, address, you know, race issues honestly, you know, because you always hold some power over someone else, which, you know, just, you know, may or may not be true given the circumstances. I think that it's good if the federal government sets an example and says, you know, look, we're not going to have this, you know, really unhealthy doctrine basically put into the federal government. But, you know, it's already being widely adopted in schools and, you know, corporate America. So I am, you know, obviously very concerned about the kind of, you know, hierarchy it's trying to create and, you know, what it says about human nature.
Molly, President Trump could have done this months ago, but it strikes me that the timing is pretty much perfect for his campaign to raise this particular issue.
Well, I'm not actually sure if there was enough awareness of what was going on in the federal government a few months ago. Very few tenacious journalists, namely Christopher Rufo, have been sounding the alarm and dealing with whistleblowers within the federal government, but it's gotten almost no big media coverage. So it actually seems like it kind of moved quickly to get it done, and it's important to get it done. Critical race theory undermines the foundations of the republic. It causes division. It creates and teaches race hatred. And so it's very, very bad for the federal government to fund in any way or to endorse. But yeah, I think it took a lot of people by surprise because they're used to seeing things like this just fester and become quite entrenched. And then when it's very difficult to root it out, that's when you might see some people taking political action. But this happened fairly quickly, hopefully quickly enough that it won't take root. We'll see.
We have talked a lot about President Trump, Molly. What has the Democratic presidential candidate Biden been up to this last week?
Well, I actually am not sure that this might sound like a weird way to put it. I'm not sure Trump is running against Biden so much as Trump is running against the media who have Biden as their candidate. And so Biden really didn't do anything. I mean, he did make a couple of very modest campaign trips to very small audiences. He responded to the media's two major hit pieces against Trump, which were the two stories we discussed. But it's probably better to just focus. If you view it as Trump is running against the media, it makes more sense to see the campaign going back and forth that way. Biden is not having that big of a role, and he struggles when he's out there. And he had a, you know, I actually personally don't believe they need to control him this much, but they're clearly controlling him to the level of having him read answers to press questions off of a teleprompter. And I think it makes him come off as if he's struggling more than he actually is. I think we all know he has some decline. He's not unable to answer press questions. Yes, he has flubs when he does it freestyle, but he also has flubs when he does it off the teleprompter. So I think it is an unwise strategy that his campaign is handling him this tightly and deferring everything to the media.
Mark, there was an almost comical press conference that he held where you commented on social media that the questions were just glaringly simple and softball.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious that the I almost said the Democratic Party, but I was referring to the media, although there isn't much of a difference these days. It's pretty obvious, you know, where their allegiances lie. I mean, the kind of questions they ask Biden, I mean, they don't ask him any tough questions. Our friend David Harsanyi wrote a great piece in National Review recently about, you know, questions that Biden should be asked. I mean, he's flip-flopping so many major policy positions because, you know, he has to appease the left wing of the Democratic Party. You know, never mind all of the, you know, backtracking he's done on the Hyde Amendment and abortion issues and stuff. He used to be, as far as the Democratic Party was concerned, a moderate. And, you know, nobody's asking any questions about any of this. They just want him to beat Trump. So they don't want to necessarily expose anything. He did an interview with Jake Tapper, I think yesterday, where Tapper asked him about the fact that I think Biden and Obama had pledged to renegotiate NAFTA, didn't do it. Trump got into office and did do it. And it was like the first remotely tough question. And frankly, it wasn't that tough a question that Biden had been asked in weeks. And he just, you know, stumbled really badly. There was a recent interview with one of Biden's, you know, top campaign people on Bret Baier's show and Fox, and they asked him about Biden using a teleprompter to ask questions, and he just, you know, he wouldn't answer. I mean, he basically deferred, tried to not answer the question about whether Biden's using a teleprompter. So the media are basically, like, running, you know, interference for Biden. There's just no question about it. And it's really just shameful, frankly. I mean, he's going to be leader of the free world. Regardless of whether you want him to be Trump or not, you know, he's still got to be properly vetted. And there's a lot going on there in terms of, you know, his mental acuity, in terms of his rapid shift of positions. American people have a right to know about.
Molly, what are your thoughts on the moderators that have been chosen for the presidential debates?
Well, to follow directly on what Mark just said, I kind of reject the idea that the media can serve the function of moderating a presidential debate because of how closely they have allied themselves with one party over another. It's less of a problem for Donald Trump because he actually does very, very well when he's dealing with hostile moderators. But I do think it's something Republicans need to think seriously about, whether they will continue to allow themselves to be treated as second-class citizens and to, you know, have to fight moderators and their opponents. Now, as for the particular moderators chosen, I actually thought Chris Wallace, who's one of the moderators, did the best moderation in 2016. I had a couple missed opportunities. Namely, he asked Donald Trump in 2016 whether he would accept the election results, but never asked Hillary Clinton. And of course, it turned out that the next 4 years were a result of Hillary Clinton and her party refusing to accept the 2016 election. And they're signaling that they might actually cause major unrest. I shouldn't even say that they might. They're laying out the plan for refusing to accept the 2020 election results in broad daylight. And so I hope that Chris Wallace asks Joe Biden about it when he moderates the first presidential debate. The others, I'd say of the rest, Steve Scully is an excellent choice. He's the C-SPAN political editor. Yes, he used to work for Biden, but he's very fair. And then Susan Page is a liberal columnist with USA Today, so I'm not entirely sure why she was chosen to be the VP moderator. And then Kristen Welker is the only of the four who is younger, you know, than I think the other three are of somewhat advanced age. Kristen would be younger, Kristen Welker at NBC News, and so she will be doing the final presidential debate. A typical White House press correspondent in terms of hostility toward the president, but don't think there are many places you can go to avoid that these days.
Mark, finally, do we have any idea how House and Senate races are shaping up?
Well, you know, a lot will depend on how well I think Trump does for Republicans. It's kind of interesting to me that, I don't know, there's a lot of elements in the Senate that don't seem to realize that their fate rests with Trump. You know, if Trump has a good showing and, you know, drives turnout, that's going to be very good for Republicans. I mean, I think Republicans are still a slight favorite to retain control of the Senate, and Democrats are still, a favorite to maintain their, control of in the House as it stands now. But, obviously a lot of it will come down to individual races. And as Molly talked about, they're already playing a lot of games at the polls. And, it's really frustrating because they say things like, all of the polls in 2016 were more or less right because they all turned out within the margin of error. But when you have an election that's decided by 60,000 votes essentially across a handful of Midwest states or whatever, even the 3 million popular vote margin that Hillary Clinton had or whatever is very small, in terms of the number of votes. So being within the margin of error doesn't really tell you anything about who's going to win in a lot of these close states and a lot of these hard fought Senate seats. So can't really tell much about the state polls at this point in time, other than, they're going to be duking it out to the end.
Mark Hemingway is senior writer for Real Clear Investigations, and Molly Hemingway is a Fox News contributor, senior editor of The Federalist, and co-author of the book Justice on Trial. You can read their columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Mark and Molly, thanks for being our guests, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
When we come back, it's Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We got our four soundbites ready to play for you. And after you've heard them, we need you to vote 1-877-623-MYIE.
Ars Moriendi, the art of dying well. If death is the punishment for sin, then how does one die well? Well, that's the question we ask and answer in the September issue of The Lutheran Witness. We ask and answer the most common questions, fears, and doubts faced by Lutherans and Christians as they approach death. To subscribe, visit cph.org/witness. cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Hi, I'm Pastor Palmer from Catalina Lutheran Church in sunny Tucson, Arizona. We're a confessional, liturgical, hymn-singing, Bible-teaching, gospel-preaching congregation, and we would love to share God's good gifts of word and sacrament with you. Look us up online at catalinalutheran.org or give us a call at 520-825-9255. God be with you.
It's been 6 years since Ad Crucem started advertising on Issues Etc., and we are so grateful for the support we have received from Pastor Wilkin and his team. In that time, we have increased our inventory substantially. We've added ornaments, church banners, jewelry, posters, and much, much more. But we still offer beautifully printed, theologically sound greeting cards that need no correction. So put away that Sharpie and come on over to adcrucem.com. That's adcrucem.com.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by becoming an Issues Etc. congregational sponsor. Calvary Lutheran, Elgin, Illinois. Gloria Dei Lutheran, Davie, Florida. Holy Cross Lutheran, Moline, Illinois. Living Faith Lutheran, Cumming, Georgia. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Cedar Falls, Iowa. Redeemer Lutheran, Fort Worth, Texas. St. John Lutheran, Algoma, Wisconsin. St. Paul Lutheran, Bridger, Montana. Trinity Lutheran, Austin, Texas. And Zion Lutheran, Douglas, Wyoming. Find out how your confessional Lutheran church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Support, Donate, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes an Issues Etc. sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal.